few slides. Now that I've talked about the FRW metric and random fields, I can talk about the standard cosmological model. We have all the tools. I'm going to show a few slides on that. And then I will go over to the blackboard and switch gears and start talking about statistics. As everyone knows, there's a standard model in cosmology. And I'm going to say what it is. So the standard cosmological model has six parameters that are listed here. Is defined by the following sequence of statements, that the background metric is FRW, the expansion history is lambda CDM, initial perturbations are Gaussian, random, adiabatic, and the power spectrum of the initial conditions is a power law. The parameters on the previous slide combined with these statements fully specify the model. And in the next few slides, I'm going to just work through the details of that. Background metric is FRW. Means that the metric has the FRW form, and the evolution of the scale factor is given by Friedman's equation. The expansion history is lambda CDM, means that the stress energy is composed of a cosmological constant piece, not a matter or non-relativistic matter piece, and a radiation or relativistic particle piece. I'm going through the first. These slides are recycled from a talk where I was explaining this in more detail, but we did a whole review on this, so I'm going through the initial slides quickly. So the first three parameters here just parameterize the expansion history or the behavior of the background in the standard model. The next two parameters, delta zeta squared and ns, specify the statistics of the initial conditions as follows. In the standard cosmological model, the FRW, the initial conditions are described as a perturbation of the FRW metric at the Big Bang or at A equals zero. And the perturbation looks like this. You just stick this function e to the 2 zeta, where zeta is a function of space but not time. At least its time derivative is zero as A approaches zero. And the field zeta, this 3D spatial field that's perturbing the initial metric is called the adiabatic curvature, or sometimes the initial curvature. That's a statistical quantity. And its statistics are described by the statement that it's a Gaussian random field with the following power spectrum. I've written the power spectrum with the factor of k cubed over 2 pi squared on the left-hand side. So this is the dimensionless power spectrum. And it's nearly scale invariant. That is, the dimensionless power spectrum is nearly independent of k. This parameter, the exponent here, is almost equal to zero. It would probably make a little more sense to define the parameter ns without the minus one here, but it's conventional to define things so that ns equals one is the scale invariant case. And the measurements show that ns is almost equal to one, but not quite. So the power spectrum is a little bit red, or there's a little bit more power on large scales compared to a scale invariant field. So the dimensionless power spectrum is a slowly varying function of k. And at a particular reference value of k, which is conventionally chosen to be 0.05 h inverse megaparsecs, dimensionless power spectrum has this value, a number around 2 times 10 to the minus 9. To interpret that power spectrum a little bit, the power law behavior means that the initial perturbations are self-similar, but not quite scale invariant. So if I magnify a small part of the box, then I'll get something which is almost statistically indistinguishable from the original box, except that it's been multiplied by a constant which is close to 1. And the power spectrum's a little bit red, so there's a little bit more power on large scales. So if I were to magnify a small part of the box, I would get a field whose fluctuations are a little bit smaller. And finally, remember that the numerical value of the dimensionless power spectrum is meaningful. It's just roughly the squared size of the typical fluctuations. So this number, 2 times 10 to the minus 9, if I take the square root of that, I get a number around 5 times 10 to the minus 5. And what that means is that the initial fluctuations are of this dimensionless size. They're perturbing the metric by roughly 1 part in 10 to the 4. Finally, so the initial perturbations are Gaussian, and the power spectrum has this two-parameter power law form. Finally, the initial perturbations are scalar adiabatic. To fully specify the initial perturbations, I need to say that they're scalar adiabatic. And scalar means that there are the initial perturbation to the metric is fully described by this function zeta. And in particular, there are no gravity waves or transverse traceless modes in the metric. So I don't need to put scalar means that there's no perturbation, traceless perturbation, hij, appearing in the metric. And the meaning of adiabatic is more technical. And here's the one part of the slides where I have to do a little bit of hand waving and come back later. It just means that so far I've described the perturbation in the metric. But to fully set up the initial conditions, if you wanted to like place every particle on the computer, you would also need to know the perturbations in all of the stress energies of the different species, the density of the baryons, the velocity of the baryons, and like similarly for cold dark matter neutrinos and so on. And adiabatic means that there's a set of rules that determine all those perturbations, that long list of perturbed quantities, out of the function zeta. For example, the initial density is described like this with a coefficient of 4/7. And there's a similar rule describing the perturbations of the individual species with different coefficients appearing in the different species.
Sorry? Could you elaborate on the fact that the perturbations are scalar only? Why is that a reasonable thing to assume?
I don't think a priori you would need to assume it. It's just that within the, in fact, many models of inflation, the so-called large field models, predict that gravity wave perturbations are present. The only reason that I've included scalar in the standard cosmological model is that within the current observational constraints, the gravity wave background is consistent with zero. So scalar is something that's true for now, but it may change if this is ever detected. By default, in the standard cosmological model, I'm just sort of including the things that we know are there, and not the things that may be there with better data. So a similar statement is true for adiabatic. Like it may be true that there, as far as we can tell with current data, the initial conditions are consistent with adiabatic, but we look for deviations from adiabaticity, and so far they haven't been found. So the first three parameters on this list are describing the expansion history, and the next two are describing the perturbations. And so to complete the description, I need to tell you about the last parameter, tau, the CMB optical depth. So to explain that parameter, first I need to tell you how the ionization history of the universe evolves. So here's a plot of the ionization fraction, or the probability that an electron is ionized versus being in an atom as a function of time. At early times, the universe is a plasma, meaning all the electrons are ionized. And then as the plasma cools, eventually the electrons fall into atoms. The universe becomes transparent, and we get the dark ages. And this transition here is where the CMB photons originate. And the dark ages continue for a long time until the universe becomes nonlinear enough to form stars. And stars release ultraviolet photons whose energies are large enough to overcome the binding energy of hydrogen atoms and ionize the universe again. And so at late times, the universe is almost completely ionized, except for like little pockets of neutral hydrogen in galaxies. So this is the ionization history of the universe. And if I observe a CMB photon today, then it may have originated here and streamed through the dark ages and not have scattered off of an electron at late times, a reionized electron at late times. Or another possibility is that the photon originated here and then it participated in one or more Thomson scattering events off of electrons after reionization. The parameter tau, or the CMB optical depth, is just the probability that an observed CMB photon scattered off of one of these low redshift electrons. And so that number is observed to be around 0.06, which means that when you observe a CMB photon in a telescope, there's a 6% chance that it, there's 94% chance it came directly from redshift 1100. And there's a 6% chance that it Thomson scattered off of an electron somewhere between now and redshift of 7 or so. So tau is really more of a nuisance parameter. At least if you're interested in fundamental physics, it's a nuisance parameter. There are people that study the physics of reionization, astrophysicists who are directly interested in tau. But for people that call themselves cosmologists, that's probably a nuisance parameter. It's included in the cosmological model because when you fit for the other parameters from the CMB, then you need to include tau in the fit and account for its uncertainty when assigning statistical errors to the other parameters. So that's the standard model of cosmology. It's described by these bullet point statements, and it has these six parameters. Just for fun, let me mention that if you ask different cosmologists, we always say it's a six-parameter model. That's sort of a slogan. But depending on who's doing the counting, you might get a different number. Like if I'm doing the counting, I say that there are eight parameters. And just for fun, I'll explain why. When you talk about the background, you would think that you need four parameters to describe the background, namely the energy densities in the four components, the baryonic matter, the cold dark matter, the radiation, and the cosmological constant. And the reason that there are only three in the standard counting is that the radiation density is not considered to be a fundamental parameter of the model. The radiation density are equivalently the CMB temperature, the 2.7 Kelvin. And I guess that's not included because you can think of it as a clock. Like if we waited a billion years to observe the CMB, we would see a redshifted CMB temperature. So by convention, that's not counted as a fundamental parameter of the model, but more of the value on a clock when we make the measurements. Personally, I feel that because you have to measure it from data and include it in parameter fits, it would make sense to treat it as a parameter, just like tau was a nuisance parameter. And finally, it seems to me that we should be including neutrino mass on the list because we know that it's non-zero. And if you were to incorrectly set it to zero, the statistical errors on neutrino mass are getting good enough that it would start to bias things. But I guess the more standard counting is to save the neutrino mass for later. When we actually detect it being different from zero at 2 sigma or 3 sigma or something, and it's not on the official list yet. Here's a standard cosmological model. And a challenge for observers, if you're on the data analysis end of the field, is to just figure out which model fits the data. The point I want to make is that this is really an empirical model that's evolved over time. And the last time the model was changed was relatively recent. In 2006, NS was first observed to be different from 1. In 1998, there was a really big surprise with the cosmological constant being added to the list of parameters. Now, if the only thing that we were doing in cosmology was if we knew that this was the correct model and the only thing that we were doing in cosmology was shrinking error bars on parameters, then I think cosmology would be kind of a boring subject. So what we really spend most of our time thinking about is extensions of the standard model, enumerating them and constraining them from data. So there's a big list of things that we looked for. I just put like the top six or my top six here before I ran out of room on the slide. But if you're an observational cosmologist, you might be interested in looking for deviations from Gaussianity in the initial conditions, a non-zero neutrino mass, maybe extra light particles other than the neutrino, a spatial curvature, which is different from zero, not non-flatness, or maybe a cosmological constant, which is not really a constant or evolves with time. And of course, cosmological gravity waves are a really exciting thing that you asked about before. Plus many more, I could continue this for another 100 bullet points or so. If you're a theorist, then this model is really interesting because its ingredients are unexpected. And so it's interesting to try to explain it at a fundamental level, like what is dark matter? That's something the universe is presenting us with, and we don't really know how it fits into particle physics. How the cosmological constant is so fine-tuned, how you can have a fundamental constant of nature which has 120 zeros after the decimal place in Planck units, but the 121st digit is non-zero. That's a strange coincidence. And finally, the standard cosmological model just describes the statistics of the initial conditions, but doesn't really explain where they came from. So of course, it's fascinating for theorists to speculate as to the physics that produced them. Another thing that theorists spend a lot of our time doing is just questioning whether we've really parameterized all the physically motivated surprises that we could be looking for in data, whether our list of extensions of the standard model is really complete, or if we have a new one, how to compute its effect on the CMB power spectrum and other observables. So the standard cosmological model just specifies the statistics of the initial conditions, where they're really tame. And if you were an observer in the initial conditions, your only cosmological parameters would be delta zeta squared, the amplitude of the power spectrum, and NS, its tilt. Between the Big Bang and the formation of the CMB, some physics which is well understood in principle, but very complicated to work out in detail, processes this featureless power spectrum into a more interesting power spectrum that depends on the value on all six of the parameters in the standard cosmological model. And then between redshift 1100 and redshifts of order 1, where we observed large-scale structure, some very different physics takes over, which is sort of simpler in principle. You have fewer degrees of freedom, and the physics is just gravitational collapse. Because it's very nonlinear, it requires a lot of numerical work, and it complicates the data analysis. For example, the power spectrum no longer contains all of the information. So in each of these three stages of the universe, different physics is important, and they kind of feel, if you're studying one of these three stages, you kind of have a different toolkit of ingredients, and it feels like a little bit of a different subfield. In fact, usually when I teach psi, I just pick one of these three bullet points, and 3 weeks is probably a good amount of time to talk about it. In this class, I'm doing something different, and I plan to mostly talk about data analysis. So most cosmology data analysis, I would say, there are plenty of exceptions, but 90% of the time, what we're doing is measuring different power spectra and fitting cosmological parameters. For example, here's the Planck power spectrum. And if I change the cosmological parameters, if I change omega lambda, for example, that shifts the power spectrum around. And so I can translate the measurement of the power spectrum to constraints in different parameter spaces. For example, this arbitrarily selected plot from the Planck results paper, which is constraining spatial curvature. There are tons of data sets. Here are some examples of data sets, that different data types that you might be interested in analyzing if you're a cosmologist. I think it's safe to say that at least right now, and for the last 20 years or so, the CMB has really been like center stage. In particular, in the six parameter space of the standard cosmological model, the CMB totally dominates the constraints. So I've put this slide is taken from a different talk, and so I've used a different parameterization here than the standard six parameter parameterization that I had before. But anyway, the point of the slide is just to show that if you take error bars on the six parameters of the standard model with using the CMB alone, using Planck data, and then Planck plus everything else you can think of, baryon acoustic oscillation measurements in galaxies at low redshift, supernovae to measure the Hubble expansion and other direct measurements of H-naught, you get parameter constraints that are maybe at most 20% tighter or so if you compare the error bars. Now, this is not necessarily true in extensions of the standard model. For example, if I had put spatial curvature on the list, then the non-CMB data sets would really help. But I think it's fair to say that the CMB is still sort of center stage. It's included in just about every interesting cosmological parameter analysis. And so I'll tend to concentrate on the CMB in the lectures. Okay, so that's it for the slides. Now I'm going to go to the blackboard, and I keep promising that the lecture is going to be mostly about statistics and data analysis. So now I'm going to fulfill that promise and start talking about statistics. So I want to build up to the question of, in the next few lectures, the topic I really want to talk about is I want to just explore the constraining power of the CMB. For cosmological parameters in different parameter spaces. What I'm going to do is set up statistical formalism and leave the numerics for problem set 2, and you'll work out like cosmological parameter constraints from the WMAP experiment. But I want to start, probably next lecture I'll start talking about CMB stuff. But I actually want to start, I kind of like starting with toy examples and building up in complexity. Like when we talked about random fields, I warmed up with the case of a random variable in one dimension. So I want to start today just by sort of like inventing statistics from scratch. And I want to talk about statistics just in general, starting with some toy examples. So here's my first toy example. Let's say a coin is flipped 100 times, and 70 heads result. I'll use the little h to denote the number of heads in an experiment where I flip a coin a bunch of times. Is it statistically plausible that the coin is fair? That is, the probability of heads is 50%. I'll say in advance that the answer is no. And there's more than one way to analyze this question, since there's more than one way of doing statistics. Broadly speaking, statistical methods can be classified as either frequentist or Bayesian. I'll explain what those words mean. So I'm going to start off by explaining how a frequentist statistician would answer this question. I'll explain what the word frequentist means in the context of this example. Imagine that you're like a lawyer and you want to argue to a jury that the coin is unfair. Then you might argue as follows. You could say, well, I simulated a bunch of experiments where one experiment is 100 flips of the coin. And I got a bunch of results, say 56 heads in the first experiment, 47. Heads in the next experiment, and so on. And I found that the probability or the frequency of occurrence of getting 70 heads now, I think it would make a little more sense to count the probability when presenting this argument, the probability of getting 70 or more heads. Is a very small number, around 6.5 times 10 to the minus 5. So that's an argument that you can really pound the table on if you're a lawyer. You can say that in a simulated experiment, you would require a statistical fluke better than 1 part in 10 to the 4 to explain the observed result. And therefore, it's statistically implausible that the coin is fair. In frequentist statistics, a p-value, or the statistical unlikeliness of a result, is always defined to be the probability of achieving that result or a more anomalous value in a repeated experiment or the frequency of occurrence. Now, one issue that always comes up is the issue of trial factors. So here's a CMB example. So I took the CMB power spectrum. And my example is a little out of date. This is the WMAP 7 power 7-year power spectrum, which is about 8 years out of date at this point. But I didn't upgrade the example to Planck yet. So here's the Lambda CDM power spectrum. And then the WMAP results are a measurement of the power spectrum for each value of L. So out to L of 1,000, there are 1,000 points with error bars corresponding to the WMAP measurements. And I noticed that the power spectrum at L equals 901 is really high. And I did the same sort of analysis. I calculated the probability that in a simulation of the WMAP experiment, I would get a value as anomalous as the observed one. And I got a really tiny number. 6.4 times 10 to the minus 4. Now, in this example, it's obvious that that tiny probability doesn't represent a real discrepancy between the WMAP results and the expected Lambda CDM power spectrum, because I didn't account for the number of chances that the data had to be anomalous. So I just cherry-picked this value from 1,000 different multipoles. And so it would make sense to include a trial factor of 1,000. And I even think it makes more, I think it makes a little more sense to take the trial factor to be 2,000 here, because it just happened to be the case that the most anomalous point was high, but it had another chance to be anomalous by being low. So there's a bit of a judgment call in whether to take the trial factor to be 1,000 or 2,000, but I like 2,000 a little better. So if I multiply this probability by 2,000, I get, you know, something of order 1. And there's no significance to this outlier. An outlier at that level would be expected given the large trial factor. So trial factors are often a source, properly accounting for them, or sometimes this is called the look elsewhere effect. Because just to introduce some equivalent terminology. And this tiny probability would be the local significance or local p-value. And then this trial factor would be the look elsewhere correction. To account for the fact that I chose to look at L of 901, but I could have chosen to look at any of these elsewhere at any of these other values. Anyway, in the coin flipping example, I kind of like including a trial factor of 2. And calling the p-value, or the probability of explaining the result as a statistical fluke, as being 1.3 times 10 to the minus 4. Because I could have also, if the coin were fair, then it could also have been anomalously low. It could instead of anomalously high. So it's sort of a judgment call, but I decided to include it that way. Now, so that's a strong argument that the coin is not fair. And in fact, we can extend the analysis to determine the, if we define a parameter theta to be the probability of heads. So we've argued that theta equals 0.5 is implausible or not consistent with the observed result. And in fact, we can extend this analysis straightforwardly to determine the range of values which are theta values which are allowed. So we start by I'm going to put a cartoon version of a plot on the blackboard, which is actually in the lecture notes that I'll publish soon. So we start at theta equals 0.5. And well, you know, let me introduce some notation. I realize that I want to label this axis, and I want to let me come back to this plot after defining a little bit of notation. So in statistics, P of x denotes the probability of some event x. And the notation P of x bar y is the conditional probability of x given y, or the probability of outcome x given assumption y. So my previous calculation could be expressed in notation this way. The probability that the head count is greater than or equal to 70, assuming that the coin is fair or that the probability of heads is 0.5, is equal to a small number, 6.5 times 10 to the minus 5. So if I plot, now imagine that I recompute that probability as a function of theta. So this curve is the conditional probability of getting 70 or more heads for a given value of theta. Then I'd find, let's say this is a log plot, so this is a tiny number around 10 to the minus 4. Then it goes up and becomes a number of order 1 if theta is equal to 0.7, of course. If I want to ask the question, what is the minimum plausible value of theta? What I would do is just threshold this probability or p-value. And I chose to threshold that at 0.025 in order to get the so-called 95% confidence interval, accounting for the factor of 2 that I talked about before. And when I did this on the computer, I got theta equals 0.6600. So according to this frequentist analysis, the smallest plausible value of theta is 0.6. And what that means is that if theta were any smaller, then I would need a statistical fluke which is less than 5% likely to explain the data. And of course, you could do the same thing on the other side. The only difference is that I compute the, if theta is a number larger than 0.7, I would want to compute the probability of getting 70 heads or fewer as a function of theta. And thresholding on the other side, I get 0.788. And so this interval is called the 95%, in this example, is called the 95% confidence interval. So this is frequentist statistics in a toy example, where the allowed range of values for a parameter just corresponds to the range where you don't need a statistical fluke at a certain unlikeliness to explain the data. And the way that's computed is that you compute the probability of getting a result as anomalous or more of the data as a function of the model parameters. And that quantity is called the p-value. And then you threshold it to determine the allowed confidence interval. I want to talk about Bayesian statistics in the same toy example. And I'll go a little faster this time. Bayesian statistics usually follows the following four-step recipe. So there's some model parameter that I want to constrain. The unknown true probability of getting heads when I flip the coin. And then there's some data that I'm using to constrain the parameter, in this case, the number of heads. So the first step is, before I look at the data, I need to decide what my prior is. This is just the probability distribution that represents my initial assumptions as to how plausible different values of theta are. So, and the results will depend on the choice of prior, but hopefully they don't depend on it very much. So in this example, a natural choice would be to say that before I look at the data, I think that theta could be anything between 0 and 1, so I'll choose the prior to be the uniform probability distribution. Step 2. Write down, compute, the conditional probability of reproducing the observed data set as a function of the model parameters, or in this case, the single parameter theta. In this example, you can work out the probability. If I do 100 coin flips and the probability of heads in each coin flip is theta and the probability of tails is 1 minus theta, then this expression would give the probability of the total number of heads being 70. This is the probability of 70 heads times the probability of 30 tails with this binomial coefficient to keep track of all the different sequences of heads and tails that you would sum over.
So, sorry, here, D is 70.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So D is the data. I switched from D to H because when I talk about statistics abstractly, I'll tend to use the notation theta for model parameters and D for some generalized data. In this example, D just means a particular outcome for the experiment, namely getting 70 hits. Okay. Step three is to apply Bayes' theorem. To get the posterior. So this is a quantity denoted P of theta given D. And what it means is that if I started with this prior, before I looked at the data, and then I looked at the data, took into account the result of the experiment, then now I have some new probability distribution on theta, which is informed by the observation. And Bayes' theorem is written abstractly like this. You just take the product of the prior and the conditional probability of getting the data given a choice of model parameters. And then you just, there's a denominator here, which just says that you put in whatever constant is needed so that the resulting posterior is a probability distribution in the sense that its integral equals 1. So I just, Bayes' theorem says that to get the posterior, I just multiply the prior times the conditional probability that I wrote down before, and then just normalize it so that it's a probability distribution. So in this example, it would look like this. Of course, you could cancel the binomial coefficients. And this is a function that you can plot. And it's a probability distribution that that peaks at 0.7. The tails fall off pretty rapidly. I probably drew them too. So that a value like 0.9 or 0.5 is in the far out in the tails of the distribution where the associated probability is very small. Now, generally speaking, in statistics, we use the word probability. To describe two different concepts. Probability sometimes means frequency of occurrence, or the probability of obtaining a given result in a repeated experiment. And sometimes probability means degree of belief. Or when I say that I like to think of it as betting odds. In this example, we're assuming that there's only one value of theta. Like, you know, theta is a model parameter, and we just don't know what it is. But it's not something that takes different values in different repetitions of the experiment. And the probability distribution is keeping track of, like, what betting odds we would assign to theta. So if I started with a uniform prior, then by assumption, what that means is that that prior distribution encapsulates the betting odds that I would assign. If someone wants to bet with me that theta is between 0.6 and 0.8, I would say that's 20% likely for the purposes of making bets. And then after I look at, if you accept that assumption, then according to Bayes' theorem, after you look at the results of the experiment, this would be the new probability distribution that you would assign to the parameter theta for purposes of making bets. Sometimes when I think about statistics, I like to you know, just in my head, keep track of which notion of probability I'm really thinking about. For example, in Bayes' theorem, you know, the prior is a probability distribution in the degree of belief sense. The conditional probability distribution is a probability distribution in the frequency of occurrence sense. And the posterior is a frequency distribution in the degree of belief sense. Anyway, once you've computed the posterior, then the last step is to interpret the posterior or assign confidence regions. And there's more than one way of doing that, even for a one variable posterior. But just to make a choice, a choice that I like in this example would be to, since it's a probability distribution, I want to integrate it. The probability distribution always means probability per unit data. So what I would do is I would start from, if I want to assign a confidence region, what I might do is start at theta equals 0 and integrate up until some threshold probability is reached. Say 0.025 for consistency with the frequentist analysis. And in this example, I find when I do that, that the endpoint occurs at theta equals 0.604. If I integrate from 0 to 0.604, if I integrate the posterior, I get probability 0.025. Or if I wanted to accept bets on the probability that the true theta is below this value, then I would say that that's a 2.5% likely occurrence for purposes of making bets. And doing the same thing on the other side, if I start at theta equals 1 and integrate down, then I get theta equals 0.781. And I get a range of theta values. So with that prescription for assigning a allowed region here in the center, then I get an allowed region which is slightly different than, but qualitatively similar to the frequentist version. By the way, sometimes allowed ranges for parameters are called credible intervals if they're Bayesian, and confidence intervals if they're frequentist. If you're a real statistician, I think you're meticulous about using that terminology, but I'm kind of hardwired to call them both confidence intervals, and I often forget to say credible interval. Anyway, the two confidence intervals are slightly different from each other, and that's okay because Bayesian statistics and frequentist statistics just differ slightly in what they mean by probability or when a parameter value is allowed. In the frequentist case, a parameter value is you decide whether a parameter value is allowed based on what level of a statistical fluke you would need in a repeated experiment to explain the result. And in Bayesian statistics, there's this somewhat more complicated story where you start with a prior that represents like your betting odds or degree of belief on the parameter, and then you update that with the data, and then you assign new betting odds, and you assign an allowed range based on whether you would be willing to make a bet with 95% odds or not.
You said that you'd hope the end result doesn't depend too much on the prior, but it seems like, just seems naively, that it depends pretty heavily on your choice of prior.
So for example, if you took a really extreme prior, like let's say I took the prior to be a delta function at 0.5. then the posterior will also be a delta function of 0.5. And that's correct. It means that if that was my prior, that means that I'm 100% sure that the true theta is 0.5. Because I've assigned 100% probability to that, then I am logically forced to interpret the outcome of any experiment as a statistical fluke and not change my prior. If you change the prior, if you don't do anything drastic and you change the prior a bit, like let's say you chose it to be peaked at 0.5 but with tails going up, it will affect the, it will shift this around a little bit, like it might shift this over a little bit. And the extent to which the final result depends on the choice of prior, it really comes down to the question of which is more constraining, the prior or the data. If you're in the situation where the data, and actually 100 coin flips, I would say, is sort of an intermediate case where the final parameter is constrained to 10% or so. If the data were very constraining, if this were, had width of order 1% or so, then the prior probably isn't going to change very, very much over the allowed range, at least if it's a reasonable prior. And the result will be pretty independent of the choice of prior. But if the data is very poorly constraining, like if you had 10 coin flips or something, then it's something that you really need to think about when you report results. Am I reporting the prior, or am I reporting what's really allowed by the data? And that, I would say, is like the main issue with Bayesian analysis, is the dependence on the choice of prior, or subtleties that can arise if the prior is playing more of a role than it should be.
So is there normally an obvious choice for prior?
There is. In general, I would. Most of the time, I think it's kind of a judgment call. You might wonder whether there's some mathematically natural prior that you can always write down. And there is something like that called, there's something called a Fisher prior. Which I will try to talk about later. It requires me introducing a little more machinery. But roughly speaking, what the Fisher prior does is it tries to assign, I'm trying to think of a good way of explaining it, but it is, roughly speaking, what it's trying to do is to assign prior weight to different regions of parameter space based on how observationally distinguishable they are. So the Fisher prior will depend on a choice of experiment or a conditional probability distribution P of D given theta, but not on the actual result of the experiment or the outcome D. And it will sort of assign equal weight to two regions of parameter space if those regions are equally distinguishable from each other once the result of the experiment is made. I explained that really badly, but I'll explain it better later. So there is kind of the answer is yes, there is a sort of a mathematically natural choice of prior that is often an interesting option. It doesn't have as much influence on Bayesian statistics as you might think. The best situation to be in is one where there's some physically motivated choice of prior. That doesn't really happen for cosmological parameters. If I'm doing a Bayesian analysis of cosmological parameters from the CMB or something, then to do that Bayesian analysis, I will have to choose a prior on, say, the neutrino mass. And what's usually done is just to choose a uniform prior in M, just for lack of any better choice. Most cosmological data analyses are Bayesian. So when you see a constraint reported in the case of neutrino mass, what might happen is you start with a uniform prior. This might go from 0 to 1 EV. And then you do your Bayesian analysis and you get some prior that might look like this, where with current world cosmological data, the 95% upper limit is at around 0.15 eV for the sum of the neutrino masses over all three species. And so when you see a result like this, what it really means is that if you believed that before we looked at any cosmological data, this uniform prior represented the betting odds that you should assign to the unknown neutrino mass, then now if someone offers you a bet that the neutrino mass is greater than 0.15 eV, then you should take 20-1 odds on that bet. That's really what it means. So my view is that, you know, frequentists and Bayesian statistics are both like logic internally consistent formalisms for doing statistics. And the difference, the trade-offs between them are mostly a matter of technical convenience or the result of thinking about pitfalls, like the dependence of Bayesian results on the choice of prior. Most cosmologists, including me, are like Bayesian by default. And I think the real reason for that is that in high-dimensional parameter spaces, like a cosmological analysis, even involving seven parameters, say, is enough. The frequentist analysis is actually very technically difficult to implement, whereas the Bayesian analysis is much more manageable due to the existence of some math tools, like the so-called Monte Carlo Markov chains, which is something that I'll talk about next week. There's some really powerful tools for sort of managing and scaling up Bayesian analysis. So that's why most cosmological results that you'll see in the literature are Bayesian. And I kind of like Bayesian statistics because it's, I don't know, I find this this picture is kind of appealing, where everything is a probability. Before you do the experiment, you have some probability distribution that it encodes your assumptions. And then you do the experiment, and there's a mathematically rigorous way of updating that probability distribution. I find it kind of aesthetically appealing. But it does have the flaw. The big flaw is that results can depend on the choice of prior, or it can, you know, creep in and influence results. And so that's always something that you have to think about. You might think that everyone would kind of have this agnostic view that they're both internally consistent ways of doing statistics, and you choose between them based on convenience. But what actually happens is that people tend to put themselves in one camp or the other and write papers where they say mean things about each other. Not sure why that is, but that's kind of like the sociology of it. Okay, so it's 12:30, so I'll stop there. Next lecture, I'm going to talk about something called the Fisher matrix that cosmologists are obsessed with, and I'll explain why.